ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a quantum computer has been just around the corner. So, where is it?
If you'd asked me very early on, I would have been very pessimistic.
The race to build a quantum computer...
Then I got more pessimistic.
Can anyone actually do it?
And more pessimistic.
One of the biggest tech stories on Earth. I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, you might think Rugby League's State of Origin has nothing to do with geopolitics.
He's very close.
But in this era of great power competition, perhaps that is changing.
The competition for power and influence in the Pacific has been on full display.
As China pushes for more influence in the Pacific, could Rugby League be the key to maintaining democratic dominance in this region? It's Hamish McDonald here on this episode of Global Roaming. We're crash-tackling soft power diplomacy.
Shortly after Australia signed a mutual defence pact with Fiji, China fired off an intercontinental ballistic missile test.
It's over! Well, that's once in a blue moon stuff, once in a back moon!
So, I don't know how many people that listen to Global Roaming are avid viewers of the State of Origin, but it's been a pretty impressive season this year and a lot of headlines, particularly out of that final match in Brisbane, when the Prime Minister was there hosting not just other state and territory leaders, but with foreign leaders, leaders of Pacific nations. And this really caught our eye. Soft power politics is something we talk about a bit on Global Roaming, but rarely do we do so in connection with rugby league. And it seems that Australia is doing quite a lot at the moment in this space. So we're going to explore it, understand how we've come to this point and what the potential implications are. Sport, of course, has long been connected with politics, geopolitics even. You might recall our episode a few weeks ago where we talked about the World Cup and the geopolitics of global football. But what's quite interesting as China seeks to exert more influence in the Pacific is the way Australia does appear to be harnessing some of those relationships, cultural relationships, through the sport of rugby league. And a couple of key features here. One is the NRL State of Origin, where the Prime Minister hosted a bunch of leaders from across the Pacific. At the same time, Australia and the NRL have announced a new rugby league team, the PNG Chiefs, to be based in Port Moresby. A huge amount of public money is going into this, Australian taxpayers' dollars, not just for the rugby league part of it, but for the nation building, I suppose, adjacent elements of all of this. And this all comes, of course, as China has test-fired an intercontinental ballistic missile in the Pacific, saying it was not directed at any nation in particular, but it does have the capacity to carry a nuclear warhead. So it certainly made some waves in the Pacific region. And you might also have caught that the new Solomons Prime Minister, Matthew Wale, has said that there is a growing consensus emerging in the region of the need for a Pacific-wide security agreement. This comes off the back of Australia signing one with Fiji. Might it be that some of these slightly more provocative steps being taken by the Chinese could lead the Pacific to form closer military security bonds? Of course, the Nakamal Agreement with Vanuatu has now been signed. That's been a long time coming and not without complication. Of course, the fact that it's the Solomons Prime Minister, Matthew Wale, proposing this or talking of a consensus around a Pacific-wide security agreement is not insignificant given that it was the Solomons that signed that agreement with the Chinese in the middle of COVID that provoked so much consternation. The Pacific is changing. The dynamics of our region are changing fast. And so Australia is looking for ways to respond. And it seems that rugby league, of course, led by a prime minister in Australia who is himself a rugby league fanatic, is a major part of what Australia is doing on the diplomatic front. Later in this episode, you're going to hear from Oliver Nobbetow from the Lowy Institute, originally from PNG, now based in Australia. He's been looking at the real detail of the geopolitics of this. But I want to start by introducing you to a friend of mine, Sam Wykes. He's a former professional rugby union player. He now fronts many of the ABC's Pacific sports programs. He's a great character, but he can really speak to the cultural impact of this. Why is it that rugby league might just be Australia's secret soft power diplomacy weapon? Hey, Sam, thanks for talking to me on Global Roaming.
Thanks, mate. It's good to be here.
Can you just tell us a bit about you first off? Because I reckon that'll help listeners understand how you're coming at this. You're a commentator these days, but you were a pro and you've got a super fascinating background.
I think a pro is probably a loose term for my former professional rugby days. So yeah, I grew up out in Western Sydney. I was rubbish at rugby league. So I went into rugby union because I thought, not that the sport is easier, I just thought my body shape being tall and I was just more suited to rugby union. And then I was able to forge a sort of 14 year career, like over with the Western Force in Perth, 5 years in Japan, finished back here in Sydney with the Tars, and then somehow I landed in some media gigs, which I don't know how, but I'm enjoying it.
You're about 7 foot tall. Is it Tongan or Samoan heritage?
Mum's Tongan, Dad's Australian.
Yeah, okay. And what's really fascinating, I think, for this conversation is that in recent years you've been darting back and forth to Pacific, commentating rugby league games, for example. And I'm hoping you can give listeners some insight to the kind of the cultural power of footy in the Pacific.
Yeah, it's been an unbelievable experience so far. So I've done a fair bit of work with that Pacific Sports Show for TV with the ABC. And then we work on a radio podcast show called Nesian Footy. And then I was doing some commentary in Fiji with Rugby Union, with the Fijian Drua. So I was going over there with the great Greg Clark. And the culture of footy, it's powerful over in the Pacific. Probably a lot of the reason why a lot of Pacific Islanders are really drawn to rugby league and rugby union. It's a physical sport, so our natural makeup and our DNA, our abilities allow us to be pretty good on the grass there. And a lot of, I guess, legends have played the game, like Jonah Lomu, Joe Rokothoko, Petro Sivinadeva. You know, those type of players really set the foundation for a lot of young boys and girls to aspire to come through and be, professional athletes. And that's where it stems from. And in the Pacific, it's just it's a sport that everyone loves playing. So it's just part of the everyday lifestyle over there.
I reckon many listeners might have caught all of these Pacific leaders there at the State of Origin in Brisbane with the Prime Minister. What does that sort of image, how does that play in the Pacific, whether it's PNG or further afield? What does that look like to ordinary citizens?
Yeah, I guess when you've got the royal family coming and celebrating Jason Taumalolo's 300th game, Daniel Tupou's 300th game, being there for the Rugby League World Cup when Tonga's playing, being there for the Ikaletahi when Rugby Union is playing, it just shows how important it is to them. So if it's important to, I guess, the hierarchy and the leaders of their countries, well, it's going to be definitely important to everyone else as well to make sure they get behind their teams.
And how powerful is this sport, or these sports maybe is a more accurate way of putting it, in kind of providing like connective tissue between nations in the Pacific and Australia, for example?
It gives guys and girls now a platform to be seen, and you get seen for your talents and they have a voice, and the power of social media now of having more of a global reach. Okay, so when you've got those type of players on that platform impressing the world, then that's going to be able to connect, like deeper conversations, not just from, from any political level, but I just think it empowers change, like behavioural changes, especially in the Pacific. It's third world when it comes to some of the privileges that we have in Australia, like, running water, just the simple things like that, shelter, all of that. Some of the villages don't have access to that. So when these players go and give back to the islands, people start to take notice and they go, oh, how can we use this platform to help create more positive change? So that's how it connects, from the players to then the social behaviours and changing people's lives.
Obviously, we're going to go on in this episode and explore the geopolitics of this, but is there any cynicism about why Australia is trying to do this, is investing in this? Because obviously these relationships are important for all sorts of reasons, but some of them are about the big grand strategy, right? Do people in the Pacific question what's the motivation of a country like Australia, or is this just broadly well received?
I reckon generally it's very well received. So like when you think of, I'll just use the Fijian Drua as an example, playing in the Super Rugby Pacific competition, you have now local heroes from the villages that have being brought up, you know, with some of the most humble sort of beginnings in life, to them being on a global stage and then someone's watching that, like, from the exact same humble beginnings. And so when that is happening on the island and you don't have to leave the island to, you know, pursue your dreams and your career overseas, like in Australia and New Zealand traditionally, or even America, they don't actually now have to leave their islands, because you think of how hard it is for a 14-year-old to leave their family and get a scholarship, say, at a school in Australia, in Brisbane or Sydney, at one of the schools there, how difficult that process is, but they understand how necessary it is to be able to help their family out.
One of the things that really strikes me about this is that it's not a one-way conversation. Like, I've spoken to you on radio in recent months where people have wanted to understand, for example, why a senior rugby league coach is wearing a necklace of chocolate wrappers, chocolate bars, and you've been explaining the kind of cultural meaning of all of this. So for our global roaming listeners, why on earth, if we're watching the footy, are we seeing more and more of this? These very colourful, what are they, chocolate necklaces?
So I think every Pacific Island will have a name for it, but in Tongan, it's called a kahoa. And so that kahoa, it's a sign of recognition, almost like how we give flowers, you know, for special occasion, flowers and chocolate for a special occasion. So that's the same thing. We present those necklaces over the neck when someone's achieved something special. So you would see them at a lot of, like, you know, the jersey presentations of someone making a debut, like milestones of the 300 game, or at the State of Origin, or anything like that. So it's just a sign of recognition and paying respects to those players. And it's probably westernized over the years with the chocolates, but it also, like my mother-in-law was saying, that the flowers in Tonga, like, are very colourful and bright. So that was like a symbol of, you know, when you put that on the necklace, you shine bright there. But because maybe they didn't have the flowers, I'm sure there is now, but like with the flowers here, they use chocolate because of the colourful wrappers. And chocolate's also a luxury as well. So that's why they would started using chocolate and flowers, and, you know, other bigger occasions, it's money, as a necklace. So you'll see that on display in all sports now. And I love that I get to see Wayne Bennett having a Kit Kat chocolate necklace around his around his neck, celebrating, because he's not going to say no to it, because he understands the, you know, the how much it means to Pacific Island culture as a sign of respect.
Sam, it's so fascinating. Thanks for helping us understand this a bit better.
No worries. Always a pleasure to be here with you, Hamish.
That was Sam Wykes, host of the ABC Sport Pacific podcast and the Pacific Sports Show. Now I want to introduce you to Oliver Nobbetow. He's the Acting Pacific Islands Program Director at the Lowy Institute. Hey, Ollie, welcome back to Global Roaming.
Thanks, Hamish. It's great to be back.
It's really good to see you. I'm so curious at your take on the idea of rugby league as diplomacy. Is it a real thing?
Yeah, look, it's interesting, right? And the questions, when you ask this to sort of any Pacific person, they tend to oscillate either between it being really good or it being really bad. I think what we've noticed is that this is something that Australia has found out that it's an unlikely comparative advantage in its contests with China, or as Penny Wong would put it, it's in the permanent contest right now for the Pacific. And it's been used as a lever for building relationships, you know, sport, not just rugby league, but broader sports diplomacy. There's no language barrier for people to engage in sport. And I think it's a real cultural lever that Australia has over the Pacific as well.
And just to help listeners understand, how is Australia, whether it's through Penny Wong and DFAT or through the Prime Minister, how are they leveraging the interest and love of this sport into actual diplomatic outcomes?
Look, it's interesting, and I think the best case on point example that we can draw to is the PNG Chiefs deal, right? When this deal was announced at the end of 2024, it was agreed that, you know, there would be support for a PNG team to play in the NRL, and they'll hit the turf in 2028. But what was traded in response to that as well was provisions within an agreement, which no one has really seen yet, but it's on securing PNG and its policing partnerships and ensuring that Australia has the power to veto the PNG Chiefs deal if there is going to be a police agreement signed between PNG and China.
And so a police deal is similar to what the Solomon Islands under Sogavare signed with China, which created so much alarm, right? And there's been a desire to ensure that there's not a repeat of that anywhere else in the region.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think given the proximity and the relationship and the size of PNG as well, it was the biggest, I guess if you you'd call it sort of the holy grail in securing Australia's security interests across the Pacific.
So as you understand it, the deal for a rugby league team is explicitly linked to security arrangements with China.
Yeah, from my understanding, yes.
That's pretty extraordinary.
It is, right? And I think, you know, when you think about the PNG Chiefs deal in sports diplomacy, right, it's a thin line that the Australian government has to walk along in order to offer this as something that, you know, the PNG government had coveted, but also it has to ensure that it's not being seen as purely transactional as well. And, you know, some of my colleagues that I have these discussions with have put it quite well, where we say that while China was the catalyst for this, as time goes on, it's becoming less about China and more about the partnership as well. So there's positive signs for this deal as well, and what that could mean for the bilateral relationship.
Is there a risk in linking these things so explicitly that it does look just transactional, that this is just about keeping China at bay in the Pacific region?
Look, yes and no. I would say yes, because I think the Pacific Island governments would prefer if Australia was upfront with its interests. And this is a criticism I think the Australian government has worn for a very long time, but it's demonstrating that it is a trusted partner. Now, it could be transactional, but it can also demonstrate that it is trusted and it is able to give the Pacific Island governments what they are interested in.
You're listening to Global Roaming from ABC Radio National with me, Hamish McDonald. From rugby league to defence pacts, on this episode, we're talking about the ways Australia is trying to project power into the Pacific. Is rugby league our secret diplomatic weapon? We're talking to the Lowy Institute's Oliver Nobbitow. So how did you read our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, turning up at the State of Origin final game in Brisbane with a bunch of Pacific Island leaders? Like, how do you interpret that as someone originally from the Pacific, but who watches this fast-changing geopolitical environment?
Look, in a way, it's not surprising. You know, I think Albanese and Marape in particular have developed a bit of a bromance over the past 2 years. You know,
this is James Marape, the PNG Prime Minister.
Yes, correct. Yes. They've built this sort of bromance and this really good rapport. I mean, they've walked Kokoda together. They signed the Puk Puk Treaty as well. They seem very fond of each other on a personal level as well. Some people say that the State of Origin date had determined when they would actually have that bilateral meeting that they have every year. It was just coincidental that it would be in Brisbane. It works for everyone. I think what was even more surprising with this meeting is that while it was initially set just for PNG and Australia, at the beginning of the week, we heard that the Tongan Prime Minister would be coming along. And on the day of the meeting as well in State of Origin, we heard that Samoa was going to be included as well. So I think it was the opportunity that Albanese had seen to sort of strike while that iron is hot in the midst of all the activity that we saw last week, you know, with the signings in Fiji, the missile test. But I think it was a perfect opportunity for Albanese to try and use that lever as well to try and talk about more broader regional initiatives as well that he has on the plate.
Yeah, you point to what is an extraordinarily busy week in the geopolitics of the Pacific, right? So these leaders turning up in Brisbane at the State of Origin, Australia and Fiji signing an agreement on defence and security, and China test launching this ballistic missile in the Pacific. It could be, in theory, nuclear armed. Mm-hmm. How does that all play in the Pacific? Like, does China's action send the Pacific closer towards itself and to Australia? Does it create the reverse effect, or does it strike fear about the implications of the Pacific getting too close to Australia?
It's a mixture of everything, right? And this is so complicated. When we were trying to sort of look at the actions last week, the biggest question I think we'll ask is, if you were a leader of a Pacific Island country, what would you do in this situation? And it's so difficult. I'm so glad I didn't have to make that decision. But the way that I saw it was that I termed it as sort of Beijing's own goal in the Pacific, right? Because that gave a clear example of what Albanese could point to and tell the Pacific Island countries, this is exactly what we are concerned about, this sort of securitization. And in a way, the best way to ensure security is to actually enter into these security partnerships and ensure that any other foreign military presences out from outside of the region are kept out in this sense.
But I suppose there's a view that some in Australia hold, which is, well, our military capacity will never rival China's. And so don't get into that kind of game with China in the Pacific. How do Pacific nations see that question?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting take, right? And the question is not asked as often, I think, in the Pacific policy-making sort of circles. In terms of military capability, right, it's nowhere near right now what Pacific Island countries would want, or to be in a manner where they could assist Australia to fight off China if there ever was sort of kinetic warfare. I think what was also quite apparent with the missile launch is that while these agreements could be signed, there actually is no capability outside in Pacific countries, like, say, a missile defense system as well, to counteract any of these actions taken by China. So while these agreements are signed and they secure the partnerships with these Pacific countries, more work needs to be done to actually make it, to ensure presence across.
Given what you've just described, are Pacific Island leaders supportive of the nuclear-powered submarines that would come under AUKUS?
Look, that's sort of like the dual side of it, right? And it's a double-edged sword. Interestingly, Pacific Island countries spoke out against the missile test, and they say that they don't want the sort of missile test to be taking place in the Pacific. But you also have to realize that the United States conducts regular missile tests as well within the EEZ of the Republic of Marshall Islands. And Australia has to be very careful in how it criticizes China, saying that there was a lack of warning being given or lack of consultation for this being done, because the same thing is what Australia was criticized of when it signed the AUKUS deal. Pacific countries felt that they were being undermined by not being consulted, because while these are nuclear-powered submarines and they're not nuclear weapons, they do have the power to carry that as well, to match what we've just seen China do.
It is significant, though, I think, that the new Solomon Islands Prime Minister has been floating this idea of a Pacific-wide regional security agreement. He says there is a growing consensus on this. Is that how you read it? Do you think that the region is moving more towards that kind of thinking?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, mainly on Prime Minister Matthew Wale from Solomon Islands, what a 180 that he's taken. I mean, Solomon Islands was the source of a lot of anxiety, security anxieties in Canberra, and now he wants to reset the relationship with Australia, which is a positive development. Now, if you'd asked me this question about whether or not a regional partnership would fly like 2 years ago, I would say no. But what we can see is that from the two agreements that were signed last week in Fiji, there was the Vivale Union with Fiji and the Oceans of Peace Alliance. The Oceans of Peace Alliance will be opened up to other militaries, well, the only other military, sorry, New Zealand, PNG, and Tonga, for them to join on board. So in a sense, it's already forming the basis of a regional military alliance across, like, call it a Pacific NATO, if you will. So it's a step in that direction. Now, initially, I thought that Pacific countries don't want to enter into these regional agreements. They kind of like to be courted individually, which is why bilateral agreements have been quite popular and quite successful in the past few years. But I think what was needed first for regional initiatives to work was for Australia to lay that groundwork and actually ensure that these political leaders, they like Australia. And I think there's a greater trust there. And then now the idea of a regional security partnership or region-wide partnership could actually hold a lot of weight.
So do you think then that footy becomes quite useful in that context?
Like,
to go back to the beginning of this conversation, is that how the football comes into it?
Yeah, I think, if anything, the football is necessary to build a rapport. It's something that they can bond over, and then these discussions can then be had after that. So it sort of builds that foundation of trust and common ground amongst all of them. I will say, though, in terms of football and the amount of money that's being pumped in, it's gotten a lot of criticism about how much money is being spent. $600 million, you know, it's not insignificant. Mm. But if you compare the numbers as well, it's quite interesting when you think about the figures. So let's say...
Can I just clarify? The $600 million itself is not just for the football, right? There's a capacity building component, whatever that means, to that funding.
Yes, that's correct. So about $600 million, just over half of that is going to the actual PNG Chiefs as the franchise to assist them to join the NRL. The rest of it is going to be used as for sports, for development initiatives across the Pacific, including PNG, Fiji and Tonga. But if you look at the amount of money as well, which is quite interesting, the ODA budget for this year is just over $5 billion Australian dollars. That's less than one-tenth of the defence budget. And if you think about the money that's being spent every year as part of the PNG NRL deal, about $60 million, that's less than 0.1% of the defence budget. So it's a massive return on investment in terms of how much Australia is getting in terms of securing the area across the Pacific instead of pumping that purely into sort of hard defence capabilities.
I think the Pacific is one area where we do tend to think more creatively about Australia's soft power tools. And obviously we were talking to Sam Wykes just before, who works for ABC Sport Pacific, and they're growing their footprint there. And there's actually quite a lot going on. Like, just looking at some of the numbers, I think 23 public broadcasters across the Indo-Pacific have signed agreements with the ABC this year. I think SAM's programs are delivered through some of this budget funding. I know that DFAT has contributed an extra $14 million to ABC Pacific on top of the $70 million investment that was already there. Is this working? Is it paying any dividends?
Look, I think so. And people may not share my optimism, but I think, you know, if you do think of this as a contest right now, I feel like Australia is ahead of the game. It's been able to step up. And if you think about it, the amount of how much has sort of been provided by the Albanese government over the just the past few years and the inroads that they have made is something that you have to sort of give credit for.
Do I detect in you a change in view? Because I reckon last time we spoke, you were a little more critical of Australia's approach.
Yeah. I think so. Like, and I think just before the time that we spoke, it was before the signing of, say, the Puk Puk Treaty. It was before the signing of the Nakamal and the Vivale Union as well.
Nakamal is the one with Vanuatu, which was complicated and delayed, but now is done.
Yeah. Delayed by 10 months, but now it's done. You know, some say it was a watered-down version, but still some quite significant wins in there. And, you know, interestingly enough, it's the only agreement that we see between, or the first agreement that Australia signed, which recognises culture and Australia's history as a blackbirder as well, which I think demonstrates how mature the relationships are becoming. So I think, you know, it's never going to be, you know, just fixed in one position. It moves back and forth, and I think right now Australia seems to be in a positive, much stronger position than it was last year.
Before we leave you, Ollie, can you describe for our listeners what it is like going to a rugby league game in the highlands of Papua New Guinea or anywhere in Papua New Guinea, frankly? Because I went early in my career and the images have never, ever, ever left me. There is just nothing quite like it in terms of understanding the impact of this game.
Absolutely, man. Look, I'm quite familiar with the games that they play in Port Moresby, the National Football Stadium. And that's where usually the PNG Hunters plays. That's where the PM's 13s plays. And the capacity for the stadium is 15,000. And you have people hanging off the rafters, really, to watch this game. The atmosphere in there, I'd compare it to something that you would say, like watching a State of Origin game. And that happens every weekend, right? There's so much excitement around there. People love the game. And, you know, initially, I'll admit, I was critical of the deal when it first got signed, but I think I'll be looking forward to Chiefs running out onto the field in 2028.
Hey, Ollie, great to see you. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you for having me.
So that was Oliver Nobitau there from the Lowy Institute, based in Sydney at the moment, but obviously from PNG originally. I think that's fascinating to hear him starting to change his view about the impact of Australia's foreign policy in the Pacific, particularly as a result of some of these soft power moves like the rugby league. Certainly, and you can probably go back and find it in your podcast feed, last time Oliver was on, I think he was far more critical of the Australian government in its approach. So I reckon this was the right time to have that conversation, but I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on this, by the way. Our email address is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Do you think rugby league diplomacy will work for Australia? Do you think the Pacific region is going to pick up what we're putting down on this? Thanks to our producers, Aston Brown on this episode, supervising producer Pat Sunderland and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. On tomorrow's episode of Global Roaming, you'll be joined by Latika Burke, and Steve Kinnane is stepping in as well. They're turning their attention to the Middle East and this US-Iran war, which seems to have kicked off again, right back where it started. They'll be asking, how on earth did we get here? Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.